It's very difficult for me to talk about this topic so briefly, because in the Augustine College program in the second half, we do the history of ideas in 1 year, because this proofs your children against loss of faith in university. As you heard this morning, you send your children to university today, they face anything from a 50 to 90% probability of emerging from that experience with no active faith. And it takes 20 years to recover. I know, I went that way. I'm not a Henry Blackaby. How many of you could not relate to Henry Blackaby this morning? Some of you put your hands up immediately, but I doubt. Sure, we relate in one level, but what a wonderful way to live. But I'm not like that. I'm a little bit of hope and grace for you, basically. I also have 4 children in the faith, but it's not because I was like Henry Blackaby. Just quite the opposite. God's grace is always available. But I took a long while to recover. And in fact, the start of that process was Galen's brother, Tim, who came into my office some many years ago now. I don't remember exactly when. He'd heard me give an extremely cynical lecture that I was asked to give by an IVCF organizer in Ottawa on why evangelical faith doesn't work in a medical environment. It has this 80 or 90% failure rate in any practical sense. You may continue to believe the story is true, but it doesn't show up at work, does it? Henry Blackaby's idea of people melting into tears every day as they get converted in your practice is not exactly what happens, is it? So Tim heard me give this lecture, and come September, he'd just got into our medical school, he rather timorously knocked on my door and said, "I heard you give a lecture. Are you a Christian?" There was some doubt after the lecture, I think. And I said, "Yes, if by that you mean do I believe the story is fundamentally true." In terms of practice, I'm not very good. And he said, "Well, there are 4 of us in first year who don't want to lose our faith. Will you help?" I was about to say no, when my mother, so to speak, turned up at the back of my head and said, "You could do that, you ought to do that." So instead of saying no, I said, "What would you like me to do?" And they said, "Well, will you do some Bible studies with us that might help us to integrate faith and practice?" And I thought about it and I said, "All right, I'll do 4 weeks. You better come to my house at 8 o'clock at night so that you're not neurotic about studying, and we'll see where we go from there." I didn't do 4 weeks, I did 10 years. And my life was changed in that process. That was the beginning of it. It took a long while. As I began to realize that the modern understanding of the world doesn't even lead to an enjoyable practice of science. We don't even know how much of the scientific literature is being fabricated at present. But it's a lot. Because if you have no fear of God, why would you not fabricate a paper if it gets you promotion? That's the fundamental problem with Darwinism. Bottom line up front is they have no explanation for altruism. They have a statistical explanation, but it doesn't describe you and me. We should get to that in due course. If I don't, you can ask me in the question period. The best deconstruction of it, by the way, up front again, is a book you all ought to get. It's called Darwinian Fairy Tales, and it's written by a man called David Stove, S-T-O-V-E. The good thing about David Stove is that good news and bad news. The good news is that he was an atheist and a philosopher, an Australian, who actually committed suicide when he found he'd got cancer. I hope that he repented before death. I don't know. But he was a hard rationalist and a very good philosopher, probably the best that Australia's produced. And whatever else he says is true about Darwin, it is no explanation of human beings. It is utterly inadequate. And he takes the whole thing to pieces, chapter by chapter, one step at a time. And he writes with passion, panache, and a pen basically dipped in venom. But you can quote David Stove, because nobody can bring up the anti-Christian bias. And he does a brilliant job. Darwin, so I'd lost my way out of this in due course. Some 10 years ago, 6 of us started a college of our own to teach the history of ideas in 1 year. Because we realized that sending kids to Bible school is no help. You can't begin by quoting scripture in the modern university. It's a starting place that goes nowhere. So to that degree, our current problem is harder than our Lord's. He could come preaching a gospel of repentance, but the kids today don't actually understand repentance because in the absence of a belief in objective moral truth, there is no sin and therefore no repentance, and therefore they cannot be set free, which is why they're using drugs, alcohol and sex in the way that they do. It's inevitable. And of course, it's not going to change until we begin at that level. So we have to start much further back. We realize that the biggest problem is that they come to university from Christian backgrounds where the education has been not very good. The church has been a disaster in terms of all the questions that actually matter. Moral relativism, the swamp from which most of the others arise, is never properly taught. Inappropriate tolerance, multiculturalism, the sanctity of life, sexuality, and Darwinism are not critiqued in a proper way. And so they have no means to answer the key questions. So they listen to very bright guys lecturing to them. What they don't know is when that very bright guy goes outside his narrow area of real competence and starts pontificating where he ought not to be. When Dawkins writes about biology in a descriptive sense, he's very good. When it comes to philosophy, he's sophomoric. Fortunately, he's being trashed by good atheist philosophers like Mary Midgley and the American whose name escapes me at the moment, but he's having a very hard time at the moment because what he wrote is indefensible when it goes outside his area of biological expertise. So what we realized is the way out of this is to teach young people the history of ideas so that they can recognize when their professors have gone outside their area of expertise. The good news is it works. We've only been taking 20 a year. We haven't got to that yet. That's as many as we'll take. We have no funds for advertising. We live on a shoestring and teach for virtually nothing. But it's a great pleasure to do it. But 80% of our graduates emerge from university with a flourishing faith, able to take on their professors. And the good news is that it's not as bad as was said this morning. The world is changing. Last year, one of our students applied to the University of Chicago for pre-med, and her interview, she'd been homeschooled. They accepted that at the University of Chicago. And then they saw she'd taken this year off at this funny place called Augustine College that they'd never heard of. The whole interview was about it, and they were fascinated. Chicago's one of your best universities. And they said, we haven't come across this before, but we'll certainly give you some credits. We need to discuss it. They decided they would give her all the liberal arts credits she needed for pre-med, for her 8 months with us, so that she could do Russian as well as pre-med. That's good. Chicago was open to the reality because medical schools have now added a new competence. Physicians must be culturally competent. I can drive a bus through that hole. You can put this on your prayer list. Next month I'm going to do grand rounds at the University of Chicago on the inappropriateness of multiculturalism to the practice of medicine, which should be fun. Hopefully it will. Now, in my part, I teach obviously the history of science, and the first part goes from ancient to 1500, basically the Copernican Revolution. The second part, of course, it's impossible to do the history of science in one term. So what we're forced to do is do what we call the major revolutions, the Copernican to Newton revolution, the Darwinian one, quantum physics and Einstein, and modern molecular biology. We can't do more than that in that time. But those are the key issues anyway. We leave a lot out, but we try and fill them in as we go along to a degree. So I've just spent, 12 or 14 hours talking about what I have to talk to you about in this one lecture. So this is going to be a bit of a whirlwind ride. I have, 25 points. My wife said, you better be organized, so I'll number them off. They're in three parts, like Gaul. A is a sequence of ideas, B is the strength of the thesis, and C is the problems, with a little bit of hope at the end. So let's start with the sequence of ideas. You can't understand what's going on unless you start a lot further back than the Enlightenment. I refuse to call it the Enlightenment. But Darwin has a long intellectual history. Cambridge has been dominated in the science area by three or four families over the last few years, last few decades, in fact, most of the 20th century. So if you belong to that inner group, which involves the Hodgkins, the Huxleys, the Darwins, the Glynns, you could sit down to Christmas lunch with four or five Nobel Prize winners in the family. That's a pretty good contribution, isn't it? We're not doing that in the evangelical world, are we? We gave up on the life of the mind 150 years ago. That's why we gave away Princeton, Yale, Harvard, and Chicago. They were ours. We gave them away through sheer intellectual laziness. And we're having to start rebuilding now. So that was the background that Darwin came from, a truly educated background, but one that had accepted reductionism. That's the first point. Secondly, he was a born naturalist. You need to pay him his dues, an incredible observer of nature. When you read The Origin and when you read the other things he wrote, the things that are really superb are his descriptions of nature. He collected beetles as a boy, you know. He was fascinated by this. When he went to university, it was a bit of a disaster because, like the modern university, for people who are really bright, it's unadventurous and uninteresting. Effectively, I hate to say this, I'm going to take flak for it, but I believe it's true. The university has been feminized in the sense that women are very justice-orientated. When girls play games, except when they're being nasty, they keep changing the rules to include everybody. Boys set the rules and are delighted when somebody is out. Those two systems are not fudgeable into one. And the one that's winning at the moment is the one that is predictable and nice. The result is, since you can't equalize upwards, we're equalizing downwards. And really bright kids get lost because they don't go anywhere in university. They're not challenged. And as long as their papers are marked by TAs, they don't even get a decent mark. It's an insider joke now that you don't know what the marks are until they get to fourth year, if they make it that far. And at long last, a professor marks a paper. The TAs didn't even understand the vocabulary of the bright guys. Because the biblical illiteracy you're talking about is not just biblical, it's across the board. We have a huge problem here. Not enough challenge. And those that they take off, they leave, or they just about squeak through, and then they've got to recover from the marks they shouldn't have got in the first place. There's absolutely no correlation between performance in medical school and performance as a doctor now. That ought to tell us to trash the system, but it's not happening. Well, Darwin wouldn't have made it today. Neither would I. I'd have got lost, bored stiff, and thrown out for non-attendance. I didn't go to lectures. Why would I? Basically, it's a failure to adapt to the invention of the printing press in most cases. Hopefully this lecture's not, but that's what most of them are. If it's already in print, why do you want to waste your time listening to me or anyone else? But fortunately, Darwin met a couple of key people at Cambridge. He met a man called Sedgwick, who was a geologist, and Henslow was a botanist. And those two, between them, set him up. It was the old boy network that got him the job on the Beagle. He shouldn't have had it, really. He didn't have the qualifications in university terms. He had them in terms of being an absolutely brilliant naturalist and having a real interest in nature, which is what you actually wanted. And when he set off, he had all the usual received opinions of his age. He believed the Bible was true. He got laughed at for it. It wasn't until he got to the Argentinian coast of South America that he began seriously to change. He'd taken Lyell's Geology with him, which had just been published, and he became convinced simply by looking at the rocks that this took a long while. Suddenly the world had got a lot older and a lot of time was at stake. And he adopted a non-catastrophic view of geological evolution and a different time course. Then he got to Galapagos. Very dull at first sight. People go there now hoping for wonderful biology. I mean, if you want to see beautiful biology, go to a rainforest, not Galapagos. But the finches were interesting. And a few other things were. And he became more convinced that it didn't look as though creation was quite as described in that wonderful poem in the first chapter of Genesis. He began to change. Now, of course, it turns out that the finches are much more likely to be a change in gene frequency than they are the real problem, which is the creation of new genes. If I send all the people who are overweight out of the room, then the gene frequency in this room will be different, but no new genes have been created. I think that's what is going on in Galapagos, which is why there haven't been many important papers out of late. Now, I haven't been through the literature recently, because by now we should have the DNA data. If it shows what I think it does, it'll probably be suppressed to a considerable degree. I ought to find time, but I'm too busy. He went off, I hope somebody will write to me when it comes up and give me the details in a form that I can understand. But he didn't know what to do with it until after the voyage was over, and it was meeting with Malthus. As he said, by chance, he happened to read Malthus on population. Sort of chance that wouldn't happen these days. Who'd read Malthus by chance? Malthus was a typical Anglican priest who was more interested in other things than preaching. One of the bishops at the time asked what a priest was. He said, somebody who can hunt and shoot and fish and provide entertainment on Sunday morning. That was the church that was around at the time. Very sad. But now, with Malthus and the key ideas, pressure for food and selection, he didn't know about genes. But of course, what David Stove does for you brilliantly is show that for us, at least, the pressures have never been sufficient to provide the outcome that is required. We do have episodes of starvation, but none of you in this room have been worrying about what you're going to eat tomorrow. Neither has anyone in America for a long while, or indeed in human history that much. It didn't happen, but only periodically. The struggle has never been sufficient. And David Stove lays that out for you very, very effectively. But it did lead to the Origin of Species. Now, when you read The Origin of Species, there's a very interesting thing. One species is very little discussed. Do you know which one it was? Us, yes, my good friend from Toronto. I don't know why he bothers to come. He could give the lecture, really. But yes, there's virtually nothing about humans. And he knew why, because what he was saying would have been unacceptable. You have to read The Descent of Man if you want to get Darwin's racist views. Eugenics came out of this background. Darwin's son-in-law, brother-in-law, can't remember the exact relationship, but Galton, related to Darwin, was the founder of the eugenics movement in Britain. And of course it spread rapidly around the world. The Origin of Species has as its subtitle privileged species, privileged races, actually. It would be unacceptable today, and Dawkins et al. Tried to make believe he never said it, but he did. The first 100 pages of the book are a brilliant opening. It's not a logical book, it's a brilliantly written one. He draws you in, and the first 100 pages are basically about domestic breeding, particularly of pigeons, and how much variation you can get by selection. Then you extend that argument without actually providing the data. Of course, he didn't have all the things that we have now. Particularly, he didn't know about genes, he didn't know about DNA. The idea of the struggle for survival and natural selection for invisible traits is a nice point that is made. You see, when we breed for what we can see. Nature, according to Darwin, breeds for reproductive advantage, which is not just what you can see. You know, I live on a farm and we raise Hereford cattle. Now, if a cow has a hard time with a calf, what happens to that cow? It doesn't breed. It's gone to it's hamburger very fast. We breed for what we want. We want cows that are big, but they've also got to drop their calves without any trouble because we don't have any fuss in winter. The last bull we sent to market had over 1,000 pounds of meat on him. quite a bull. We had to send him because we thought he might crush the heifers next year. You know, we can breed that way, and there's a limit to what we can achieve. And Darwin knew that, but he didn't make that point. He had a lot to say about the fossil record, and of course he took the view that it could be held to be incomplete, but we didn't have enough time to look. Now, of course, Stephen Jay Gould, towards the end of his life, said, well, we know that it's incomplete, and it's going to be incomplete because that's the way it is. And hence you get his view of how it happens, that development of new species has to happen in isolated communities, and therefore the probability of the fossils ever being found is minimal. It's a kind of... Yeah, of course you can't find it. If you could, it wouldn't have happened. Now, there is some evidence for it, and one of the important things to get straight and make sure that your Christian school teaches this is that species do evolve. It's well documented, particularly the fruit flies in Hawaii have been very well documented. There were none till we took them there, and there are now distinct species that don't interbreed. That's the clear evolution of species. The same is true of certain birds. And other, some warblers, the whole process has been documented. So the world that God created has in it the capacity to create new species at that level. Maybe up to genus, we don't know how far that will go. But don't get too uptight on how you talk about these things. We'll come back to these things. I'm taking you very quickly through what happened to Darwin's sequence of ideas, and then I'll take you further back. What happens, you see, is when you've got an isolated group, they don't have to compete because the ecological niche is open. Otherwise, if it happened in the big one, they just get overwhelmed by the majority. That's not happening when they're isolated. And then when they've got some adaptive advantage, they might become big enough to take over. So you have to give that that sequence is probably available. How far can it be taken is the question. Darwin was also well aware that geographical differences were not related so much to the physical conditions of the geographical area, but to the physical barriers that provided these isolated environments. And then you get entirely different sorts of creatures, like Australia and other isolated areas that have their own creatures. So you got evidence for some things going on which a literalist approach to the Bible would not have accepted. Now, some of the other things he used have died on him completely. His arguments using Haeckel's embryos and from development, of course, nobody would pose those anymore, because any decent embryologist can tell you what kind of animal is going to come out of it. When you're just at a few 8 or 16 cell stage, they may go through a similar process of development, but they have entirely different pathways in terms of the biochemistry. He didn't know about that. Homology also, of course, has turned out to be a non-argument, although it's still in all the textbooks, for the same reasons that we now know that what looks homologous can have entirely different genetic bases. So why did it succeed? Section B. There were 16 points in that first one, actually, if you got them. Section B. Why did it succeed? Well, first of all, it had a huge explanatory power. Scientists are always looking for models that explain the world. And we need to recognize what's going on. I used to begin my biochemistry course. Fortunately, being a well-funded researcher, I didn't have to teach until fourth year. I managed to avoid the first 3 years of disaster. One of my colleagues used to say, and I agreed with him entirely, the university would be a great place if only we could get rid of the students. Teaching the herd of independent minds, you know, it's not the most joyful thing on earth. But I began to teach at fourth year. And I would begin the lecture by saying to students who just spent a lot of money studying atoms for 3 years, that atoms don't exist. Now, at least I got their interest immediately. The point I wanted to make, of course, is that we fall in love with our metaphors. What we do as scientists is we build models or metaphors to explain reality. And the atom is a metaphor. Many of my colleagues say, I just work in science, you know. But human beings can only think in metaphors. We have no other way of doing it, really, except mathematics. And that comes along. I'm going to blow this microphone away again in a moment. And so the model of the atom is good enough to allow us to build an antibiotic, for instance. But it will not explain the facts of quantum physics. It's a good model, but it's inadequate. Just like Newton's model of the universe was a good one, but it's inadequate. It only works at a certain level. We need to recognize these things. Science is always provisional. Once you get that point over, especially in biochemistry, if I wanted to be up to date, I'd have to rewrite all my lectures every year. That was a problem until I realized that students' basic problem was to learn how to write themselves and how to critique a paper. That I could do without having to keep up to date with what may not be true next year. You know, I never used to go to meetings because the posters that are there have less than a 15% probability of making it through peer review. So unless I can work out which one in six it is that's going to get through peer review, I'm wasting my time. At one stage in my career, I could probably critique 0.501% of the literature because I maintain that you can't critique it unless you can read the methodology with understanding. Otherwise, evidence-based medicine today is basically authority. If it's in a good journal by somebody with a track record and it's been peer-reviewed, it's true. Well, if you believe that, you're exceedingly naive. It's not a bad place to start, but don't confuse it with, you know, the objectivity they would like you to believe that it has. No, these things change from year to year. Whereas the metaphysical world, when you're talking about relativism as we were at the moment, relativism comes in layers, I hope you understand that. Metaphysical relativism would say there is no truth. Very few people would actually hold that position, I think, thoughtful people. Epistemological relativism would say there may be truth, but we can't know it. And then you come on right down onto spiritual relativism, which says you cannot know the spiritual truth about the world. Whereas, of course, in actual fact, some of these things are so clear that we shouldn't bother about them at all. The world is divided between true statements and false statements, isn't it? Somebody could say to you tomorrow that you were not here, and you may or may not be able to prove to them satisfactorily that you were. It makes no difference to the fact that you were. So about every statement in the world, truth or falsehood is a possibility. Whether I can know it about any particular one, that's a different matter. But to say that thing doesn't exist because of my individual incapacity to know, that's stupid. So the world goes from truth to falsehood, honor to dishonor, fidelity to infidelity, love to hatred. That's the metaphysical moral universe we inhabit, and we have no other. It's always been like that. So, but what had happened with the Newtonian revolution was huge. More of this tomorrow, so I can skip it quickly now. But the church screwed up in various ways, and science took off in terms of a rapidly augmenting power over nature. So once Newton had given us a mechanical metaphor for the universe, the watchmaker, it was less than 100 years before Laplace famously said to Napoleon, when asked where God fitted in his science, "Sire, I have no need of that hypothesis." He could do that science without reference to God. And in fact, I maintain that science should be done tacitly atheistically. Now, don't get me wrong. It does not mean that I, as a scientist, do not believe in God. What it means is that insofar as I am doing science, I am trying to understand what I believe to be God's world as far as possible without reference to God. To find to what extent God has delegated to us a system of knowledge that will work independently of acknowledging his existence. And that can be done. That's reductionism. As a Christian who started it off, again, more of that tomorrow, so I won't bother with Occam at the moment. But it's an interesting story, and we'll talk more about the extensive one later. Once reductionism had taken over, especially in physics and chemistry, of course the biologists wanted in, but they had no metaphor. And what Darwin did was give them a metaphor, a model. an evolutionary model. And of course, do you think that worked well with Britain in the middle of an industrial revolution with robber barons who were grinding the faces of the poor? You bet it did. Survival of the fittest, which of course is a nonsense sentence, isn't it, really? Whenever you hear it, you say, do you mean survival of the survivors? What does that mean? It doesn't help me at all. Survival of the fittest is nonsense at one level. I mean, it's not telling you anything that isn't obvious. Of course the fittest survive. You've got to go further back to pursue the argument properly. But, of course, for the robber barons, it was great. The poor, well, it's just natural selection, isn't it? Well, natural selection is on our side in one area at all. One of the points that wasn't made this morning, which was, I can never resist when you get to this gay, lesbian, bisexual, transsexual nonsense, you know. There's some good news in here, you know. The Western world, without exception, apart from the US, is failing to reproduce. And the US is only maintaining its population because you have a leaky southern border, which you shouldn't seal. Because at least they're not Muslims. It would make difference if your southern border was Iran. That's the problem that France, Germany and Britain face, and it's a serious one, but not for you. Now, there was a little while ago now, in Foreign Affairs of all places, I came across an interesting article and forgot to note it down, by a British epidemiologist, demographer, who pointed this out, that the problem of the Western world is not overpopulation, but underpopulation. When the population goes down, the economy goes down. And he was not pleased about it. But he says, within this data, there's another piece of data that he also was honest about but didn't like. And it is this, that people of faith are having three children. Secularists are having one. You don't have to be a brilliant mathematician to see what that means, because by and large, 80% of you were loved into your current position. That's about the probability that your children will eventually end up in your neck of the woods. They may take a 20-year detour, as I did, but that's where they'll end up. So we win. That's why Hillary is in such trouble, because she knows that if Americans vote their consciences and recognize the need for the lesser of two evils, then they must vote for the most pro-life candidate available if you want a human rights-based society. Because rights are not laid out like a smorgasbord where you take the ones you want and leave the others. They are ordered. If you do not have a right to life, you have no other rights, because they're all dependent upon that one. That's why it's first. Pseudo-rights have no responsibilities, real rights do. You can sort them out fairly quickly. But you may not like the candidates you have at the next election, but you have to vote for the one who's going to take the most pro-life position, and the party that will, in that sense. And that will lead you forward. So Hillary knows that. She's not stupid. That's why she's trying so hard to find a way to be pro-choice and pro-life simultaneously. And so illogical are Americans, she may succeed. I don't know. And Americans includes Canadians in this context. You know, my experience is roughly equal in the two areas now, but I often put totally illogical comments into lectures just to see whether anyone will notice. And I don't say anything, and usually they don't, and then somebody comes up and says, you know, yes, of course I did. I've just been waiting. You're the first to say that. I certainly did it to medical students, because I could find out who were the bright ones that way. One of my favorite examples was up this morning. I wouldn't have done it quite the way it was done this morning. I quote Romans 12:2. But I actually misquote it. And you can try this in any of your congregations. You'll be amazed at the response. I say, oh, why were the epistles written? Nobody knows. Send me to sleep on Sunday morning would probably be a true thought about what they might be for. But actually they were written for practical reasons, because the church was screwing up and the apostles thought that theology could help. So a lot of theology, and then therefore, and then some very simple ethics. Biblical ethics are very simple. Love your spouse, both ways around. If you're a man, you better reverence her. That's a bit further. She should too. But look after your children properly and pay your workers. Not very extensive ethics. Roughly the same in every epistle. But Paul says something like this. He says, if you followed my argument, then you ought not to be like the people around you. You ought to be transformed by the renewal of your feelings. Now, not everybody even here got it immediately, even after this morning's lecture. But you do it on Sunday morning, especially in an Episcopal church. Nobody will notice. I go to the Episcopal church, so I know this. Because they come to church on Sunday morning to feel better. So, actually, do most seeker-friendly churches, don't they? Why else would you sing 7-Eleven songs and the like? I mean, it's sort of cheap pop psychology, isn't it? If I was a pastor, you know, I don't think I'd have any singing until after the sermon. Because then, hopefully, there might be something you could sing about. When I get to church, the first thing I need is confession. I can't even drive to church without needing that. So, but most churches have no repentance of sin anymore, do they? This is total aside. Must get back on track. Back to Darwin. He bought into this reductionistic model because of the power that had come to Laplace, and he wanted one that would work just as well for biology, and he thought he'd got it. And everybody said, yes, he had. Thomas Huxley was furious. He said, why didn't I think of that? The point is that Darwin could write. The Origin of Species is brilliantly written. That he sold that thesis against the will of many Christians like Louis Agassiz and Harvard and the like, who said, no, this is clearly not true. There are a lot of people who are opposed to him who actually knew something. It's like global warming now. Many of the people are on the bandwagon know nothing about weather, about meteorology. That's the way we are now. And the same thing happened then. The arguments against it were good and they were made well, but they didn't carry the day because people wanted to believe that. In the Victorian world, it made political and social sense to the people who were in power, the elite who rule, who have called the agenda for a long while. And we need to recognize that. In addition, it had wonderful, powerful proponents. Huxley was a marvelous debater, Darwin's bulldog. He wanted atheism. He wanted those Anglican priests out of science. Because, of course, the most important thing most Anglican vicars did was to write the botany of their parish. And they were actually interested in botany and in natural history. And they wrote good stuff, but he wanted them out of there. And he needed a model to get them out of this. And he succeeded. Spencer, the Origin of the Survival of the Fittest, was a social Darwinian. Nasty man in many ways, if you took him seriously. Marx bought into it. Marx liked Darwin a lot. So did Hitler. So did the Nazis. Yeah, it works. There's one position where we can use the natural selection thing. I have, as I've said, 17 grandchildren. My third daughter has 7 children. They love kids. And when she got about 4, she was living in our house at that stage. We lived in the apartment in the top of our house. They'd taken over our house, you know. I went away one weekend. We'd put an apartment at the top when the kids left so that they could have somewhere to crash. But I went away one weekend and my wife had decided we should crash and Nicola and Tim should have the house. They needed it more, was her view. Basically, she didn't want to clean it. But and they took over the house. But when we bought it, it was not a very trendy place, but it's, you know, inner city gentrification has served us well. So the yuppies live there now. And so Nicola, with 4 children, was getting rude comments. Even in church, there were evangelicals who said to her, don't you know about contraception? I tried to persuade her to say, well, it's just natural selection. But she wouldn't. Instead, they joined an evangelical Catholic church because nobody says that there. We are not as child-friendly as we like to believe, you know. We're not. Just you look around your church, and we need to change that. We need to become very child-friendly. It's important to our own survival and the nation's. But, my last granddaughter born to Nicola was... Not all babies are beautiful, are they? They are in the eyes of the mother, but Eliana was a little princess from birth, and she knew it. And when Nicola went off to church, there were a row of guys at the door waiting. And Eliana was whipped out of her hands, and they would fight about who was going to hold her, more or less. She didn't see her for an hour and a half every Sunday morning. That's a child-friendly church, an evangelical Catholic church in this case. They even pray in tongues, so if you close your eyes, you wonder where you are, you know. The only giveaway is that the priest has a better vocabulary than most Pentecostals. He did pick up the point, yes. So that was the strength of the thesis. It gave them a model they could run with, and it was one that helped them to achieve many objectives that weren't related to science. Now, the problems. First of all, don't make any problem with the evolution of species. Give that away instantly. We made the usual mistake of fighting the battle in the wrong place. Secondly, we need to recognize that at the heart of the problem is a philosophical problem, not a biological one. Some of you have heard me say this before, but it's worth saying again, because if you haven't used it, you should. A few years ago, I was in Cuba. I go there pretty regularly to teach medicine and ethics, and they allow me to teach pastors as well, as long as I don't push the envelope too far. I have done that on occasion, and then I don't get a visa for a couple of years. But on one occasion, I was teaching medicine, and at the end of the lecture, I got an invitation. And the invitation was to debate the head of Marxism and Leninism in the local university the next day, the next morning, in front of the faculty. And the debate was to be on the nature of ethics. Ethics as a human invention, or in my case, ethics as the product of a human discovery. Which is it? Now, no academic would turn that down. I mean, this is just too much fun to turn down. Even if you lose, it's going to be fun, so why not? So I got one evening to prepare, so I said my prayers, and debates, the opening matters, and I had several that I knew would work. But I also knew that there was a better one. I didn't know what it was. Now, there's no neurophysiologist can tell you how you know that there's a better way of doing something when you don't know what it is, but that was the truth. The good Lord usually deals with me with ironic humor, usually at my expense. And he didn't give me the answer until I got up from the front row to walk to the lectern to do my part of the opening discussion. And into my head popped a new first 10 minutes to the lecture, instantly, in a millisecond. How can that be done? But I saw it. I knew exactly how to do it and where to go. Fortunately, I had a good Colombian translator, and I said, Hugo, I've changed the start. He said, fine, what do you want me to do? And I said, well, first write on the blackboard in Spanish, this message assembled itself. So he did. And then I asked all the profs, graduate students and the like, if you'd come into the lecture room and found this on the board, would you believe it to be true? And of course, none of them would. I mean, this message assembled itself. It doesn't make any kind of sense. And I complimented them on their intelligence and generally made them feel good for a minute or two. And then I turned around and crossed out message and put in DNA. This DNA formed itself. Now, I said, you do believe this sentence now. Now, it's the same sentence. Message and DNA are interchangeable. It's just that DNA is message in gobbledygook. But it's the same thing. It's not you and me. It's a message specifying how to make you and me. Fred Hoyle, who was numerate and thoughtful and an atheist, used to say, expecting me to believe simple Darwinianism is like expecting me to believe that a hurricane blows through a scrapyard and I get a 747. I find that hard to believe. But actually, it's much worse than that. You must have a hurricane blowing through a scrapyard of metal and get a neatly bound set of working drawings written on paper telling you how to make a 747. That's the problem. See, you and I are largely protein, but DNA is not. So the protein is the metal of the 747. The bases are the paper, if you like. Now, the interesting thing that happened in Cuba that never happens in America, do you know what happened when I said, don't you see it's the same message? The audience burst into applause. because they've been struggling with scientific reductionism applied to ethics and people for a long while. And they were not happy. And they realized that I was going to take it to pieces. In fact, I'd already done so as far as they were concerned. The debate was over. How can you begin to think about a message without a message writer? We don't have minds that can do that. And when you look at the probabilities that are involved at this level, and it's not being done at this level very much, interestingly, the cosmologists are way ahead of the biologists. Cosmologists have in effect been talking about design for a long while, but they do it in a somewhat ironic, cynical, throwaway way, and so nobody minds. We stupidly sent a lawyer to argue about biology whose clear objective was to change the educational system to a more Christian one. That's red rag in the face of a bull. It wasn't a smart move at one level. I mean, Philip Johnson's a smart guy, he's a good debater, and we probably didn't have too many biologists who could do it, but the liberals are not going to stand for that. But in the cosmological area, sure, they've stood for it for a long while. You get Roger Penrose writing in one of his many books, he says, "It looks to me as though the maker's aim has to be accurate to one part raised to the power 10, raised to the power 127. Now, I don't know about you, but I can't think about a number with 127 zeros. And says Penrose, neither can anyone else. It's certainly more than all the particles in the cosmos. When you get to that level of probability, you're talking about zero. It didn't happen that way. Now, cosmology has been saying that for some time, so about 90% of them are sort of soft theists, or deists at the least, people like Hawking, who has God on every other page pretty well of A Brief History of Time, but he's not Christian. But something beyond the box that we were talking about this morning is not unacceptable to many of them. They wouldn't buy the nonsense that's going on in the world. So there's good news for us out there, if we can play our cards correctly. Now, of course, philosophically, talking about message is an important way to go with biology. The next thing is to talk very seriously about altruism. Message and altruism are two key issues. Darwin himself understood this. He said, his problem was that if his theory was true, then whether something was accepted in that theory did not depend upon its truth, but upon its reproductive advantage. So if a lie gave you reproductive advantage, it was just as good as truth. But that would mean that you couldn't believe anyone. So morality is a lost cause. Now, there's been a huge attempt to come up with models of altruism. And they can get as far as group altruism. And you shouldn't deny that. That was Willie Hamilton's contribution, and they loved him so much they gave him an obituary in both Science and Nature when he died. But what you need to understand about his model is that it doesn't describe you and me. For it to work, imagine that you're crossing a bridge over a river and someone jumps in to commit suicide. Now, for Willie Hamilton's model to work, you have to stop for a second. If it's your identical twin brother, you jump immediately to rescue him. If it's just a sibling, you hesitate for a moment or two. If it's a cousin, perhaps a minute or two. By the time you get to an outer Mongolian, it's 20 minutes. Now, that produces group altruism. In other words, your decision ought to relate to the percentage of shared genes you have with the person you're rescuing. But of course, it's nonsense. It doesn't describe the way we behave. And of course, who puts more into their siblings, other siblings or parents? And who has the greater number of genes? It's the wrong way around. And David Stove does a magnificent job at ironically taking this all to pieces for you. So that's where the argument needs to be established. Now, as far as Genesis 1 is concerned, I normally avoid this issue like the plague in the United States because some of you are going to hate my guts afterwards, but so be it. I'm getting old. Maybe it's time I was put out to grass. People listen to me and they wonder whether I'm a closet liberal. Actually, I'm much more orthodox than most of them are. I wouldn't accept many of the things that go on in many churches at the moment. I think God chooses us more than we choose God. There is a choice involved, but you've got the cat and the mouse the wrong way around when you talk about choosing Jesus. I like the way Henry Blackaby did it this morning. No one comes except when God draws them. But from their point of view, when it comes to Scripture, there's a problem. And being intellectually lazy, as I've said already, is a good way to give away the house. And so rather than doing the thinking that's required, they want a nice, simple question that will solve the problem for them. And so they ask me, do you believe the Bible is literally true? Now, raise your hand if you think the Bible is literally true. Raise your hand if you think it isn't. Raise your hand if you're asleep. No, you can't. Yeah. Now, actually, none of you do. And I can prove that to you. When Jesus says, I am the door, do any of you look for a handle? Of course not. You all recognize that that is a literary device called a metaphor. And if you don't recognize a metaphor when you should and treat it as a literal fact, you'd be in deep trouble. A schizophrenic might go looking for a handle. Because, as you know, schizophrenia has a primary delusion, and then the rest is logic. I remember my introduction to this as a student when a very intelligent Jew developed acute schizophrenia. And he came to us because of what happened next. He was walking down a street in London, and suddenly his primary delusion was that he was Jesus Christ. And the rest was logic. He said, if I'm Jesus Christ, that church is about me. I've never been inside. I better see if they're doing it right. So he went in. He didn't like the way it was organized at all. So he reorganized it, moved the altar and everything else. He had a lot of energy. The whole internal architecture of the church, insofar as it was mobile, was moved. And then he turned on the organ and lay down full length on the keys because he wanted some noise. That brought in the janitor and he came to us. When asked about the noise, he said that was God saying, well done. He was totally logical. He didn't recognize what was happening. And we, unfortunately, go that way quite frequently. So you all recognize metaphors. Now, when in Mark's Gospel it says that they sat down in the feeding of the 5,000, they sat down on the grass and it was green. Is that a metaphor? It's not, is it? This is reportage. It has no spiritual significance. But what it's telling you is that Mark was there. You can imagine him sitting at his desk writing, and he's just got, I better write about the feeding of the 5,000. And he sort of shuts his eyes and looks back, and he says, wow. He sees all those, in his mind's eye, those people sitting against a green background. He tells you what time of the year it is. Things are not green all the year in Israel. This is reportage. The man was there. He saw it happen. Now, if I read a story to you that began once upon a time in the land of Uz, what kind of story would that be? It'd be a fairy tale, wouldn't it? It's also the opening of Tolkien's translation of the Book of Job. Now, who knows more about ancient literature and what genre it belongs to, you or Tolkien? If you're prepared to say you, it's the end of discussion, because this is not arrogance, this is idiocy. Tolkien knew what he was doing. And you're, half of you are physicians. Do you imagine that if you were covered with boils, you'd sit down on the ground and have long philosophical discussions about whether God can be known and what suffering is about? I don't think so. Maybe afterwards. I'm sure there was a story like that underlying it, but the essential structure of the book is a poetic device. And if you don't recognize that, you're in trouble. Now, the church had troubles with this. The earth is fixed and it shall not be moved forever. Why is that an important text in church history? Galileo story, yeah. The Catholic Church at that point was up for a sharp lesson. It opposed Galileo because to say that it was not literally true might lead the faithful astray. Now, it's in the Psalms. If you don't recognize poetry for poetry, you're going to misread the text. My love is a gazelle, really? Not quite. I'm not into that sort of thing, you've got to recognize what you're reading. Now, by this time I can usually bail out, but for you guys, I'll take it to the next step. When you come to read Genesis 1, now I'll say more about this tomorrow so it can be very brief, but Do you know what the first thing ancient people asked about a story was? We ask, how does it fit together, right? The first thing we do, we've got that kind of mechanical mindset. We want all the bits to fit together like a nice jigsaw puzzle. But that wasn't the question of the ancient world. What was the ancient world's question? True's a difficult word at this level. No, they didn't ask that either. They asked, what is the story for? See, we got rid of that with enlightenment. Again, more of this tomorrow, so you're going to have to put all the pieces together properly. But no, the first question was, what is this story for? What's its purpose? Teleology, which disappeared with the Enlightenment. But we can't live without it. It's interesting how God has stings in every tail that we try to cut off, and they bite us. But no, you go to Africa, for instance, and a given tribe might have two or three creation stories that don't fit together. Does it bother them? No, because they explain different aspects of why we're here and where do we come from. So take that idea and apply it now to Genesis 1. Now, if you've got any poetry in your soul, when you see, and it was good, 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 and on the seventh day God rested, that ought to give you a sense that the writer has a pattern in mind and he's putting the data into that pattern. But what was the, how's best to put this question to you? What was the key purpose of Genesis 1, or purposes? What would you say? If you were asked to choose the most important statements in Genesis 1, what would they be? Yeah, God, in the beginning, God. I mean, first sentences usually matter. Not in the beginning, the matter. No, in the beginning, God. Who has no physical existence. So that's different from the cosmologies around them where, you know, there were sort of gods and goddesses all over the place reproducing earths and the like, you know. It was very much more fabulous. But here, a straight statement, in the beginning, God. What would you choose as your second one? You won't all agree with me, but we can play this game a little bit. Sorry? Well, you've got that in the beginning, God. Is your man, I think, yeah. Let us make man in our own image. Nothing else has that characteristic. And, of course, God has no physical image. So what makes man different is his metaphysical image, the capacity to know good and evil. The capacity, as one sense, they were naive at that stage, but the capacity existed. And to know friendship, to know all the things in the moral environment that is God's nature. So you can see how that's going to work. We now have a very different creation. Now what about the second story in creation? There are two, aren't there? I hope you don't deny that. And they don't fit together. What's the second one about?
Man's fall.
Man's fall, yeah. Why I fight with my wife and have done for 40 years. Yeah, because I'm a fallen creature and she's trying to pick me up, you know, basically. No, it's about sin, the fall. And in fact, the sequence of creation such as it is in the second story is not compatible with the first. Didn't matter to the ancient world, because that idea is only two or three centuries old in any dominant way. That's our problem. This is the reductionism that affects the church as well. And your children have got to understand what reductionism is. Reductionism is when you pretend, and it is a pretense, that when you take something to pieces, like a cell, it's no more than the sum of its parts. Now, it's a very useful technique. I did reductionistic science for 25 years. It paid the bills. It kept me off the streets. You know, I would have done a lot of damage otherwise. And some of it I believe to have been true and to be still operative today. But it is reductionism. The world is actually bigger than that. It's more complex than that. But it's a powerful technique. And that's what I mean by saying that science should be tacitly atheistic. It's a scientific fiction that naturalism is true. Just like the lawyers have a legal fiction that you become a human being when you are born. That gets them off the hook. They recognize it's a legal fiction, but it makes the law clean. The scientific reductionism gives a clean methodology. And as long as that methodology, as long as the methodology is sound, nobody should have any grounds for not publishing my material. Science is methodologically rigorous, but philosophically and logically usually not very good, but the methodology sorts it out over time. So reading my papers, you wouldn't know whether I believed in God or did not believe in God, and it's irrelevant to the actual paper itself. What matters is that the methodology be solid and be properly used. Then you have to accept the results. You don't have to accept the discussion, it's usually wrong anyway, but the methods and the data are what matter. And that process came into the church as well, you see. The ancient world's way of thinking, which I'll deal with tomorrow, was much richer than ours. But Protestant theology was formed just at a time when this reductionistic model was coming to the fore. Now, before the Newtonian Revolution, the world was thought of as being mysterious, understandably. There was little control over nature. But by the time Darwin had finished, we had a mechanical metaphor, the clockmaker, if you like. All the I's dotted, all the T's crossed. Of course, quantum physics has wrecked that, but he didn't know about that. It lasted for 300 years, pretty good run. Only Ptolemy beats it, I think. But and Ptolemy was wrong, too. That's where we were. And so Reformed theology, Protestant theology, lacks the element of mystery. We want all the I's dotted and all the T's crossed. So we actually frequently propose, because of this, growing up in this ethos that goes on in the Darwinian model, even our preaching of the gospel is often propositional. Here are a series of propositions. Do you believe in God? Tick. Do you believe Jesus is the Son of God? Have you confessed your sins? Have you asked him into your life? Tick, tick, tick. Sign here, you're a Christian. Maybe, maybe not. That's not the way it happens. That allows you perhaps to know where you are, but it wasn't what happened. Think about your own conversion. So when you listen to a Protestant theologian of the 16th, 17th century writing, Sola Scriptura, if you listen very carefully, you can hear a little whispered comment, we'll tell you what it means. This is authority, isn't it? There's no uninterpreted text. But God says no. Jesus, you see, his way of doing it was, let me tell you a story. He tells you a story, he says, now go figure. That's the Jesus way. And we're going to come back to that. And the young are actually wide open to it. I get the best receptions in highly liberal environments. Later on I'm going to do teach you how to do this on abortion, but I regularly give lectures on abortion, totally deconstructing a woman's right to choose in the most liberal universities in the world. Now what you won't believe is the outcome. The lecture has ended in dead silence every single time I have given it. I have yet to have an aggressive question at the end of it. That's what can be done when we start thinking our way through these things. So the question your kids have to ask is, in the beginning, what? Something or nothing. Where did altruism come to? And how come, as Belinsky wondrously puts it, there is the eerie discovery of a message at the heart of every cell? In this film that was, you should all watch, I haven't seen it yet, what was the title? The title doesn't fix in my mind, but Expelled, yes, the people are being thrown out of the university because they don't know how to go about it. The other thing you must put on your fridge, when it comes to Christian statements in the next little while, when you feel impelled to make a statement, bite your tongue, say a prayer, and ask God to change it into a question. I teach my students who are Christians, never, ever, under any circumstances, make a public statement about Christianity in the university. Ask a question that impels the answers. Is there any difference between the statement, I believe in God, and I believe in no God, philosophically? Are either of those two statements provable in a way that everyone has to accept? The answer has to be no. So do we not have to come up with a way of living that honors both of the starting premises? You can go a long way with that. Time is up. Those of you who wish to go can. If there are any questions, I'd be happy to try and answer them.
Sir.
When was the application of variation of species applied then to mutation from fish to amphibian to mammal?
It has never been applied. It was assumed.
Yeah.
And the problem is all...
How did that happen?
Well, we don't know how far this can go. The genetics revolution is in a most interesting stage now. I mean, this was pure reductionism. The genome was going to give us everything. It came as a bit of a shock when we found that rice had more genes than we do. And of course, the literature is all now about epigenetic factors. Our genes, unlike most other genes, are multifactorial, multifunctional. Sorry, not multifactorial, multifunctional. So depending upon the life period of our organism and the epigenetic factors, the same gene can have different functions. So this is making it all very, very complex and very, very interesting. Clearly, the fact that every living creature has the same DNA code, to me, that looks like a designer, but he could also work for a Darwinian. But this is where the two premises can each use that data. When I walk around our city at home, since I'm good friends with one of the architects who's been busy in that city for 25 years, I can recognize Barry Hoban's buildings because they always have a Barry Hoban motif. It's not that one building evolved into the other, it has the same architect. But there are other things that clearly evolved, don't they? The design of cars was an evolutionary process. I don't know how God did it. One of the really interesting things for me is to find out what God actually did. But that's going to wait till heaven, isn't it? What we should tell our children all the while is that you are never required to lie on God's behalf. And we have a terrible tendency in the evangelical church to do that. I remember being asked a few years ago to do the midweek sermon at one of the more fundamentalist Bible schools in North America, and I thought, this is a surprise, they haven't done their homework on me. And they clearly hadn't, but I chose to preach on truth to 1,000 kids or so, I guess. And halfway through the sermon, I said to the students, with the faculty all sitting behind me, I said, if you came to believe in the next month or two that Darwin was right, would you feel free to express that opinion in this school? Raise your hand if you would. How many people do you think raised their hands? Six, actually. And I turned to the faculty and said, you have a problem. Because the primary good in the world is not loyalty, it's truth. And you're suppressing it. Only if they speak the truth can they be open to vigorous discussion. Whereas if they come to that decision and walk away, they're going to call you bigots for the rest of your life, with some justification. Now, those six followed me to the next lecture, which was in the secular university, and begged me to go out to lunch with them, which I gladly did. Amazingly, that college invited me back about 5 years later to do a week's lectures. And they have changed. So that's what we have to do, and we can do that. Any other questions? Anybody who is really interested in the education of your young, and I mean really interested, come and see me. I have a few brochures with me in my bag. But do go to augustinecollege.org, and you can read about us. You can go to my website, if it's easier, johnpatrick.ca, not .com. He claims to be the world's greatest gambler. CA stands not for California, but for Canada. It's where the weather comes from in winter. So do go there. And if you know bright kids in your school, in your church rather, who don't know what they want to do, club together and send them to us for 8 months. For God's sake, don't let them go and do sociology or psychology while they work out what they want to be, because it'll take them 20 years to recover from that.
Does the website have a reading list?
It does, extensive, on both mine and the college one. Thank you.